And welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For a political party that champions small government, the Republican Party also has a long history of big activist presidential moves. Emancipation, the creation of the national income tax, interstate highways, or the vast expansion of public education. So that's a tension that's at the heart of today's GOP, a Republican Party that, according to my next guest, is in perpetual tension between the idea of equal opportunity and the need to protect property. It's a debate that's raged within the party and within the nation since its very founding, and it has profound implications, of course, for our present and future. Joining me now is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of the new book, Tracing the History of the GOP. It's titled, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, I wonder if you could just start by telling us a little bit more about why you picked these two particular polls, the idea of equal opportunity and the need to protect property, as sort of where the tension in the Republican Party lies.
Well, I didn't pick them. The Republican Party picked them, and America picked them before the Republican Party got around to it. The trick was that the Declaration of Independence established the idea that every man should have a right to work his own way up. That was a set of principles that the Founding Fathers wrote into the Declaration. But when they wrote the Constitution, they had a different set of problems, and they wrote in that the need to protect private property. They thought at the time that there was going to be enough resources in the West for men to be able to work their way up, regardless of whether or not the main idea of the government was to protect property. But almost immediately after the Revolution, they discovered that that was not the case. Men poured into Kentucky, people like Daniel Boone and Abraham Lincoln's grandfather, also named Abraham Lincoln, went to Kentucky to work their way up, only to find that slave owners came in and took over all the land and ran the legislature. So from those two central tensions, we got the two central tensions in America, and those tensions then later on played out in the Republican Party, founded in part by the first Abraham Lincoln's grandson, our Abraham Lincoln.
Right, and that was 1854, right? I mean, because roughly then. I mean,
then,
you quote how Abraham Lincoln basically at one time said that Republicans are both for man and the dollar, but in cases of conflict, the man before the dollar.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about how during the Civil War and during Abe Lincoln's time, this the side of the Republican Party that championed opportunity for all really flourished.
Well, before the Civil War, the government was controlled by Southern Democrats who didn't want the government to do anything because they were afraid that if it did anything, it would start to mess around with slavery. When Lincoln is elected, before he is inaugurated, those Southern Democrats simply walk away and they turn the government over to the brand new Republican Party, which has these principles but no real policies yet because they are less than a decade old. As soon as the Democrats are gone and the Republicans have to start using the government to raise money to fight this extraordinary war, not only money but also men and supplies and ships and guns to fight this extraordinary war, they start to experiment. And very quickly they do things like pass the Homestead Act, which gives men land to farm, the Transcontinental Railroad Act, which gives us a railroad for men to get out west. And especially the Land-Grant College Act, which gives us public universities. Eventually, in 1865, of course, they pass the 13th Amendment, letting every man have a shot at freedom and working his way up. And that's really the origins of the American activist government, is there with the Republican Party during the Civil War. And, of course, to pay for all these things, they do things like invent national taxation, including the income tax.
Right. And I don't remember exactly who it was at the time, but for someone within the party basically said in times of need, 99% or 100% of an individual's property should belong to the government.
99%, and that was Justin Smith Morrill of Vermont, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds basically entirely unimaginable today that those words could come from an ostensible member of the GOP.
Yeah, that is not, however, made up. Yes, people say that anybody pointing to that fact must be a communist. But in fact, it did happen. He was founding member of the Republican Party, yeah. Justin Smith Morrill, 1861.
Well, but so this is really interesting, and I want to spend a little bit more time about what happened during, you know, in terms of the creation of the Republican Party, its you know, massive actions during the Civil War, and then of course after the Civil War, because as you write, basically immediately after the Civil War, there was pushback from within the party itself in terms of the direction that it had gone, and you know, all these accomplishments or huge programs that you just outlined. Where was that pushback coming from in particular?
Well, those programs I just talked about were enormously popular, first of all. But remember, this is a northern party. It's an enormously popular party in the north. The idea that if you let the government cater to every person in society, let the government represent anybody who's trying to work his way up, and it's him at this point in American history, to work his way up. Before the Civil War in the South, Southern Democrats said, you simply can't do that, because if you let poor men have a say in government, they're going to vote to redistribute wealth. And if they do that, they will make sure that the very wealthy members of society will not be able to pull their money together and use it to get great educations and buy great art and move society forward. So their efforts to redistribute wealth, that is, to give themselves some piece of what they had produced, would destroy advancing society. After the Civil War, when Andrew Johnson becomes president, he is very fond of those sorts of arguments for different reasons, because, of course, he's not a Republican. He's elected on the Republican ticket, but he's actually from the Democratic Party. And he brings that language first to the North and then through a very odd series of events into the Republican Party. So by 1871, you've got some Republicans saying that, in fact, the whole idea of having a government that does good stuff for everyday people will lead to the redistribution of wealth. And by 1871, Republicans are already talking about socialism and communism. Generations before the Bolshevik Revolution, socialism and communism are the buzzwords of the 1870s.
You go so far as to say that in roughly 30 years following the end of the Civil War, that Republicans who had, quote, once been the driving agents of economic opportunity had become the engineers of economic ruin. I mean, those are pretty strong words.
Well, there's a leap from what I just talked about, yeah. the fear of communism, to the Panic of 1893. And what happens there is that after this, the 1870s moved to seeing any kind of an activist government as socialist or communist. The party quite deliberately ties itself to big businessmen, especially in New York. And that's because of some of the peculiarities of post-Civil War elections. The New York has 35 electoral votes, and you simply must have it to win an election. And in order to win New York, you got to win Wall Street. So the party ties itself to Wall Street in the 1870s and then in the 1880s. But they become convinced, as more and more people dislike the laws that they're passing, the laws that support big business and protect the rise of what are now called robber barons, and by the 1890s were beginning to be called robber barons, they start to believe that anybody who disagrees with them must be evil, must be anti-American, must be a traitor. So when, in fact, voters return a Democratic government, including a president and the House and Senate, in 1892, the Republicans instantly say, we're going down the road to socialism, down the road to communism. The world is going to fall apart. This is the apocalypse. Take your money out of the stock market. Send your money home. Literally put it under your mattress. Throw people out of work so that they will never make the mistake of electing Democrats again. And they toss the nation into its first national depression in 1893, which is always associated with Cleveland, but in fact erupts under the previous Republican administration 10 days before Cleveland takes office.
Okay, so then you push in the book, you take us through history as it advances from this point on, and you spend a lot of time talking about what happens next in terms of Theodore Roosevelt, right? Because basically, in your analysis, he swings the pendulum of the party back from that by calling for government regulation of business, regulated railroad shipping rates, a very big deal. He was a trust buster, famously, and protection of public lands, to say the least. So I'm just wondering if that's one example of many, and we can go through several others as we sort of ease into the present of the Republican Party, that the most potent and corrective forces for change have always lied within the party itself.
Yes, and that's a really good point, simply because Roosevelt and the people who operated with him, Henry Cabot Lodge, Fighting Bob La Follette, Albert Beveridge of Indiana, they decided not to break off and be a third party, not to be the mugwumps, as the independent reformers were known at the time, and to reform from within. And they were far more effective from within than the people from without.
Okay. And the reason why I ask that is because I'm coming back to this, the dichotomy that you raise in the book, To Make Men Free, about the tension between championing a government that supports equal opportunity for all and protection of property, property and property rights. I mean, that seems to be, to me, not necessarily just an exclusive to the realm of Republicans, but rather a very American tension. I mean, don't we see the same sort of struggles within the Democratic Party as well?
It is absolutely an American tension, and it is a legitimate tension because our two founding documents have principles that are fundamentally in tension with each other. When the Founding Fathers did not find a way to reconcile those two things because they didn't feel the need to, that left a hole, a political hole in the American system. And what I have tried to argue is that the Republican Party, as it was initially formed, was designed to be the political apparatus that could resolve those two tensions. And sometimes it does quite well, but it never really entirely managed to resolve that tension within itself. And we still are fighting that same battle today.
Okay, so a little later on I'll ask you if you think that tension can ever be resolved. But hold your thought on that for a second. Listeners, I'm talking to Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of the very compelling new book, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. So let's talk a little bit more about the specifics of that history, because, you know, we just touched upon Theodore Roosevelt, who obviously has deserved many a book on his own. But I do want to talk about the 1920s backlash then that happened to all the changes that Roosevelt and his administration put in, because I just love this quotation from President Calvin Coolidge, that the chief business of the American people is business. So tell me more about that.
I love the 1920s. The 1920s are a great deal of fun because it is the one time in American history that the Republican pro-business platform is able to be put in practice without any fetters. They really have control of everything. And it looks really, really good for most of the 20s. The numbers all look good. People think that America is on a trajectory to a place where they finally have managed to make everybody in the entire country upwardly mobile. Of course, as we know, it looks really good on paper, but in fact, it leads to the Great Depression. But the people like Coolidge who embrace that ideology and who are pushing it, and Andrew Mellon at the Treasury and Herbert Hoover as well, they really believe it. And it looks to them like it really works. Like if you simply cut taxes, let businessmen run everything, push everybody to invest in business, that in fact what you're going to do is create sort of a giant, I hate to say it, but almost a giant pyramid scheme where wealth trickles down and everybody moves up. And it seems like it's going to work. The only problem, of course, is that it doesn't.
Well, in 1929, of course, we have, as we were just talking about, the crash and the beginning of the Great Depression. And it's not so much even just policies that I find intriguing that you write about in the book, but just core attitudes, right? Because you talk about how Andrew Mellon, a Treasury Secretary, I've just got to read this whole quotation from him because it's really rather eye-opening. He says in this time period that really the way to fix America is to liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate real estate. Quote, it will purge the rottenness out of the system. High costs of living and high living will come down. People will work harder, live a more moral life, and enterprising people will pick up the wrecks from less competent people. So Andrew Mellon using some pretty strong language there, but it's language that we've heard echoes of, you know, even
ever
in
since.
More recent times.
Ever since. And you heard it before. That's sort of the fun of this, is the 1890s and the 1930s and the more recent years. If I put quotations in front of you and did not tell you what years they were from, you wouldn't be able to tell. One of the solutions for the Depression that the Chicago Tribune, which was one of the most staunch Republican papers at the time, put forward was that the only way to solve the Depression was to cut taxes and to take jobs and wages away from these grasping public servants and teachers who were taking too much of the public money and making businessmen uncomfortable because they were always worried that they were going to lose you know, their profits in taxes.
Well, you know, it's interesting to have this conversation with you because, of course, by virtue of being in New England, we're home to this brand, a particular brand of republicanism, which is basically, many would say, extinct in the current day and age. But I wanted to just read you a couple other thoughts from folks who have reviewed your book, who say that they question your call for the GOP to really follow the lead of Lincoln and Roosevelt and Eisenhower, who we actually haven't had a lot of time to talk about, because they point out that Lincoln, obviously, and Roosevelt and Eisenhower all won office. Won the presidency, I should say, without winning the House. And I'm sorry, without winning the South, I should say, because the geography is the important thing here. And forgive me for bumbling around the place, but this is an important point here. Because Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine wrote this. He said, "We're unlikely to return to a mid-20th century situation where the white South is going to support the more liberal party in presidential politics. American politics has instead returned to what appears historically to be its natural state, given that the alliance between the white South and the Republican Party has grown more firm than ever today. It is hard to imagine how the party can refashion itself along Lincolnian or Rooseveltian lines." I mean, he's basically saying he doesn't think that your call for a return to the party of Lincoln in its truest state is even possible.
Well, I'd like to think it is. He's pointing to the Southern strategy that Nixon employed.
Right.
And, you know, Nixon had to turn to Strom Thurmond to move the Goldwater voters into his column because he was in trouble. But it's worth remembering that Eisenhower, in fact, did try to do this. And this is one of the ways in which his coalition broke down, is Eisenhower firmly believed that the South would get behind him and tried very hard to create a Republican Party that welcomed African Americans. He appointed one of his White House aides was African American, who went on to write a book about it. Similarly, even the Lincolnian policies, and to some degree Teddy Roosevelt's, were intended to encourage both black and white middle class or rising middle class people to join behind the Republican Party. I think it's a question of vision. It's a question of deciding what we think the government should do and what kind of America we want to live in. I hate to think that we're going to spend our lives up against a wall.
Well, but many Republicans today would hear that and say, but we do know what kind of vision that we want. And they very passionately point to Ronald Reagan as the man who epitomized that vision of prosperity, optimism, a form of government expansion and deficit spending, et cetera, and that he continues to be the leading light and should be, in their minds, the leading light of the Republican Party.
Yes, and there has been that criticism of this book, too. And I would say only to that if you look at these at the Reagan era historically as opposed to politically and with a dog in that fight, if you will, the Reagan years looked very good again on paper, but the deficit spending was extraordinary. That was essentially a government works program hidden underneath the books. We tripled the debt in those years. We went from being a creditor nation to a debtor nation. That's not sustainable. That's not a tenable position for a nation to be in. There were other things as well that contributed to the Reagan boom. I think the other problem with looking to Reagan right now is that, look at places like Kansas that has tried to run down this road. And even Kansas is now in danger of becoming a purple state because that sort of a government really does not serve the majority of American people. And I do believe that they're going to turn against it. And what worries me in terms of looking at a resurrected Republican Party is that, this happened in the 1920s and the 1890s. If you go too far down the road of protection of property and by gerrymandering, by manipulating the government to make sure that you stay in power, which the Republicans did in the 1890s by adding six new states in a year, but certainly they did plenty of things in the 1920s as well. The backlash against that is so extraordinary that you throw everything else out of whack the other direction. And I don't think today's Republicans understand just how up against the wall they are.
Well, let's talk about why today's Republicans even continue to call themselves that. Because there's a question that was raised by a review of your book in The New Republic. And that question is, if the best Republican beliefs, those of the 19th century that we began this conversation with, seemingly are identical with democratic liberalism, and today conservatism can't even function as a check on liberalism, then why have a Republican Party at all?
Well, I personally believe that the Republican and Democratic parties are here to stay simply because they have the machinery in place, and it's very difficult to start a new kind of machinery after all these years. So I think that somehow we're going to have to work within these two things. The Republican Party became the idea that liberalism is somehow associated solely with the Democratic Party is a misnomer that was pegged onto the party in 1954 by William F. Buckley Jr. in his McCarthy and His Enemies, in which he argued that there were good people like Buckley and his friends who believed that the government should do nothing but promote big business and promote religion and defense, and anything else was liberalism. And he called that liberalism with a capital L to make it look like communism with a capital C. Within that, if you throw out Buckley's division of the world into him and liberals, which I think is where our language has gone nowadays, and turn the conversation back into a larger one about the American consensus that we lived with under Lincoln, Roosevelt, and Eisenhower, where the vast majority of Americans believed in a spectrum of behavior, although they disagreed just how far along that spectrum different people should be. I think there's plenty of room for both a Republican and a Democratic Party. They do tend to emphasize very different things and how things are going to be done. But that's, in order to do that, you've got to throw out the idea that there's a pure small group and everybody else is somehow corrupted by liberalism with a capital L.
Okay, so finally I want to get back to this question that I was teasing you with earlier, and that is about resolving the core tensions, because you've basically written that the history of the GOP really shows why, since the Civil War, that the party and the nation really has been caught in cycles of progressivism and reaction for 200 plus years. And is it possible for the party or the United States as a whole to resolve that tension? I'm curious, okay, first of all, do you think it's possible? And secondly, maybe why would we want to? Because within that cycle, that back and forth, it seems as if the tension itself could be the very fuel for progress. Because every time that we have reaction, what follows is some sort of progress.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. And maybe you're right on that. I think for people living within the times like now, Liz, I think you're right. I think we're going to have a huge backlash against where we are right now and that our children will live to see it. It's awfully uncomfortable for the people who are at the bottom of the scale right now, who can't make ends meet, who can't pay for daycare, who are working three jobs. And it is, I think, legitimate to argue that, just as people argued against Mellon in the 1930s, that it might end up historically in a good place, but that doesn't do very much for Americans nowadays. Is it possible to resolve it? Yes, I think there's a number of ways to resolve it, but perhaps the most interesting for listeners might be that we are in a new era. The internet has thrown us into a completely new era in which one of the ways that the Republican Party has traditionally turned against government activism is by linking it with aid to minorities. That's not a dog that's going to hunt very well, I don't think, in the mid-21st century. I think that as generations pass on in this country, there will be less power in race baiting and less power in specters of communism because, you know, frankly, the next generation doesn't even know what communism is.
Well, Heather Cox Richardson is author of the new book, To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. She's also professor of history at Boston College. Professor Richardson, thank you so much for coming in today. It was a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, there's more of the show in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.